just to talk about some of the issues. One is that the total regional power pool reserves are tight because all the western states have grown. And so there's some concern about that. And there's a real drought in the hydro system. We've had a real drought in the West Coast.
Does that include DC Hydro, which has been one of the places that we've got potential hydropower at very high prices?
They have also had some drought, but not as much as British Columbia. They've had some, but not as much. They've had plenty up there. Okay.
Yep.
Every if I remember the numbers right, every small customer of BC Hydro got a check for $240 and said, "Thank California." No, I'm just kidding. One of the things that was lost was the coordinated maintenance scheduling and system operation that was done away with, and it was not picked up by the ISO. In other areas, the ISO has picked this up. But before, the utilities used to maintain that maintenance schedule. They used to be very careful about how they did. The rule of thumb was that you needed about 25% capacity reserve. The feeling was that a well-operated market would probably cut that capacity reserve down. You could operate with 10 or 12. That's not what's turning out to be. Okay?
Was the forced divestiture of your power plants part of the scheme in other areas?
Yes. Well, not forced. Basically, the utilities were said, listen, we can't force you to divest of those power plants, but if you don't, you're not going to collect the $25 billion for stranded costs.
Did they divest?
Yes. Yes. The only thing utilities have left is nuclear and hydro. All fossil plants in California have been divested and bought up by Reliant, all the other firms that are out there, Duke.
In Pennsylvania, did they divest?
Yes, they divested, but they divested with a long-term power sales contract as part of the purchase agreement.
Renewable
and biomass, in most cases, was under their PURPA. They're called QFs, qualifying facilities. They're under contract to the utilities. The utilities would not release them from their contracts and have not paid them. That's why some of the renewables went offline, because they weren't getting money to pay their people. The bankruptcy judge just ordered PG&E to pay them, I think, 30% of what they're owed, and they're now back online. So they're under most of the renewables, a few or not. Most of the renewables are under contract to the utilities. Here's the energy demand in California population growth. You can see that we're really not the western state that's grown the most. Nor is our demand necessarily grown the most. Okay? But what that does do, it does suck up extra stuff that's out in these outlying states. So there isn't as much of that available to ship into California, particularly during peak. Okay, now here's the capacity outages. Okay? October 99, scheduled means the guy says, hey, I know if something's wrong, I'm going to schedule my outage, okay? Unscheduled or forced, it says, oh, I just woke up this morning, tried to turn on the power plant, and something's wrong, and I got to go down, okay? Notice the difference between October of 99 and October of 2000. Remember now that demand between October 99 and October-November 99 and October-November 2000 wasn't much different. Okay.
Does any of that have anything to do with possibly Y2K, that the effect of it on the equipment that they weren't really telling to them?
Well, the explanation is that they had to run so hard in the summer of 99 that they had to shut the equipment down and it began to fail. Okay. Now, what you notice here is that essentially the capacity outages took 12,000 megawatts off the market. Okay? And we had blackouts at roughly 28,000 to 30,000 megawatts, which is, this is almost half of the demand. Okay? Now, the other thing I know from working at PG&E is that every day, there is something in a power plant that isn't running right. And most of the time, you just run and fix it. But if you wanted to, you could say, we've got to come down for maintenance. And it's extremely difficult to prove you didn't have to. The other thing is, I think some of the maintenance, additional maintenance, is probably due to the fact that to some extent the power plants are run by the traders in the trading sections of these companies. Okay. That is, the traders are telling the power plants when to turn on and off. And the more you cycle a power plant, the tougher it is in terms of its whole physical being. And so that the worst thing you can do to a power plant is turn it on and off in short intervals, because you get this delta T, this temperature differential, which really wreaks havoc with any metals or any kind of material, right? You cycle temperature. So you weaken it by doing that. But already the stories are coming out that the traders would make these power plants turn it on and off on hourly intervals. And the other thing you know is that during the wintertime, that some of the power plants, when the price of gas went up, some of the power plants turned off and sold the natural gas because the profit on the natural gas was more than the profit on the electricity. Now, the minute you do that, you, of course, take capacity off the market, which drives up the electricity price. So then you switch back to electricity production when the profit level on the electricity went above the profit level on the gas. Okay?
Now, is that intentional, or is that...
You bet. Hey, it's a good American way. You want to maximize profit. Come on. And if there's no rule against it, that's exactly what you'd expect. In fact, if you didn't do it, the stockholders ought to fire the CEO. I mean, now, I don't think it's ethical, okay, but you're playing with something that does have public goods benefits to it. So, but I don't think anybody expected that. Okay. So, I mean, you know, people ask me, well, why would they be doing that? And I said, well, look, I'm a young guy. I'm 25 or 26 years old. I'm on the trading floor of Dynacon or Enron or Duke, right? And I've got a bonus program, right? And it says you make money for the company, you get a bonus, right? And so these guys are just like stock traders, right? They're in there. They've got the best computer systems in the world. They trade commodities all over the place. They've got the world's best meteorologists. They have the computer programs that tell them what demands. Predict and all that kind of stuff. And so they're looking at gas prices, they're looking at these prices, they're playing these power. You can bid the power, even if you have a 600 megawatt power plant, you can bid it in 200 megawatt intervals. You don't have to bid the whole thing at once. That's the way the ISO rules are. So I can just see these guys, young guys, huge bonus program, and he's saying, man, God, I can work this thing. You know, he sees this, he slips in here, he turns the thing here, and meet each night for a beer, right? At the local bar, the guy from... The guy from Duke meets and the guy from there meet the local bar in Houston, and he says, well, how much did you make the company today? And the guy says, I made $50 million. By God, I turned off gas. And the other guy says, well, I made $53 million. You're buying. Okay? Now, there's nothing, if they don't talk about it beforehand, again, I'm telling you, there's nothing illegal about that. There's nothing illegal in U.S. laws about gouging. There is about colluding. They can't get together at the bar and say, tomorrow I'm going to do this if you do that.
But,
that's against the law.
But with this distributed processing from very sophisticated AI computer network, which you got very familiar with, the computers can communicate with each other. Doesn't that serve, in a sense, create a de facto form of communication? It's not something legal. It's just like an emergent realm that...
My guess is the whole question about what information you put on the web, what's available to people, how do you play it, And I think inherent in it is the very volatility of this particular commodity. Again, it has no storage capability. So that means it really is a very volatile commodity. And I think it's just subject to a lot of things. And you have to mitigate against that. And in fact, this happened early in deregulation in the UK. But the UK has what's called a regulator. And he was specifically charged by the government to enter the market and correct it if he saw fault.
Well, this is what I'm getting after. If you look at the stock market and you have this extremely complex automated trading system network, most of the traders are looking at their AI engines, and the AI engines tell them what to do. So when the correction happens,
and we, you know, when the correction put a fix in the market, so we wouldn't have blocks on Sunday or whatever.
That's right. So what this implies is, like, you need for the same kind of simple corrections we apply here in this market.
I mean, wouldn't that be something you would...
I guess if something like that will emerge. But remember, now the whole country is not deregulated. We're in a mixture of one or the other. We have no, we don't have the, what, but in the stock market is the SEC. With this, with the equivalent is the FERC. The SEC is very mindful of that. They're always watching the market. They're always in, looking to see if anybody's doing anything and punishing people who go way out of line. FERC is sitting there saying, forget it, California, it's your problem. So you have a, yeah, I think there's a way to fix the market. And that's what I'm, you know, I'm sort of advocating that we do that. I don't want to abandon it. But we have a lot of things to be done. We basically put something in place that has some real flaws in it. Okay, now that's the relationship of natural gas to electricity. One of the things about California is that in the wintertime, the pipeline capacity feeding California is not enough to meet the demand for natural gas. California has two utilities, Southern Cal Edison and Pacific Gas and Electric Company, have huge underground natural gas storage facilities. The Delta out here in San Francisco, underneath the Delta, is an old, depleted natural gas field that is now natural gas storage. So for those of you that are, some of you are old enough to remember the tanks that used to be on the streets, right? Those were all gone because they developed this underground storage facility. So that in the, what you're supposed to do in the summertime, and the demand for natural gas is low, is to fill up the storage capacity. Because in the winter, you bring in this gas by pipeline and you withdraw from the storage capacity in order to meet the demand in California. Natural gas was deregulated. Nobody was required to store. If you wanted to store it, pay. You had to pay for it. The only one required to store were the utilities for their small customers, you and I. But not the power plants, not the other users. They went on the market for that. Okay? So what happened is that they did not store. The other thing was that the pipeline capacity coming in, most of the pipeline capacity coming into California from the south, was sold off by El Paso to their merchant, their unregulated subsidiary. And the data for this is very sketchy. It's still hidden. You can't get a hold of it. But what appeared is that they ran the capacity price so up so high that nobody wanted to ship natural gas into the state. So in essence, again, you created a natural gas shortage, which drove the price of natural gas in California high. The minute you drive the natural gas in California high, the electricity prices rise. Just in a quick calculation, and this is those of you that are mathematical purists will probably hate me for this. In a gas turbine, roughly speaking, it costs you about 2 cents a kilowatt hour to convert the fuel to electricity. If the natural gas comes in somewhere around $3 per million BTU, the price of electricity, and this is slightly high, is about 4 cents. So if the gas price goes from $3 a million BTU to $6 a million BTU, the gas price now goes up from 4 cents to 6 cents, because remember, the fixed costs stay the same. The fuel prices go up. So that if it went up to 9 cents, you'd go to 6 plus 2, 8 cents per kilowatt hour. You go up to $12 per million BTU, you go up to something like, let's see, 2 times 4 is 8, times 2 is 10 cents a kilowatt hour. Okay? So the natural gas price directly affects the price as you go along. Let me go back, but I forgot something. This is natural gas prices at the hubs, okay? I'll show you that. Darn, I got to fix this. I got to learn how to do this so it doesn't keep changing on me. Okay, the other thing was that you had a drought, which decreased hydro, which increased demand for natural gas. And then you had the nuclear plants, Southern California Edison's nuclear plants out for a while, which took some stuff off. And you had some of the coldest winter in the U.S., which increased gas demand in other places. So gas was tight any way you look at it. But what happened with us was that there was a real gaming with the pipelines coming in, and we didn't store gas that we should have stored. So we had a real gas shortage and prices went up.
Carl, pursuant to your point on the drought, I understand the large head hydro projects are able to pump down through the generator and then they pump back into the hole.
Pump hydro?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So aren't they able to mitigate against some of that drought effect, but not enough? Is that your point?
Well, you don't have that much pumped hydro in the West. We have a, there's a pumped hydro facility that's in conjunction with the Abitania nuclear power plant, because nuclear power plants can't go up and down. So basically you run them base loaded all the time. So if the demand shifts, you basically go to pumped hydro and then run it through the hydro system. So Helms Pump Storage is in association with, it's about 350 megawatts. The total pumped hydro in the West, and I'm sorry, I don't know the numbers, but it's less than 1,000 megawatts. Okay, it's not much. And the other, so that you had all of this pressure on natural gas.
Okay.
Now, the interesting thing is, here's natural gas prices at the various hubs, okay? Notice that in all cases, the natural gas price in California was somewhere between twice to three times what it was in the rest of the country. Okay? And you saw that increase, because natural gas prices were not capped. So you saw that on your bill. Any of you ever look at your bill, both the natural gas side and the electric side, you get information on what those prices are if you look at it closely. Okay? So that you saw the increase in natural gas, probably just thought your whole bill went up. But your electricity side didn't go up, because that's capped. But the gas side went up. So when you saw your bill increases this winter, it was natural gas price increases, not electricity price increases. Because it didn't get passed on to you. That's why utilities are bankrupt. Okay? And the state's in debt. But notice, right? I looked yesterday, and I think that was the right number, and it was so low I was first not going to put it in. But yesterday, it looked like at the Southern California border it was $3.45 a million BTU, and the rest of the country had dropped down to less than three. Now, what's going on here? I have no idea. Okay, I mean it is a very precipitous price drop. I can, you know, I can conjecture all kinds of stories. I don't know. I'm going to watch to see what happens and how long it stays and what's going on with it. Yes, yes.
The paper is saying that's due to a very cool summer so far for the last 2 weeks.
Right now, I don't believe anything you're saying. So I don't know. Even me, I wouldn't believe myself, you know. I just, yeah, I mean, it may well be that one of the things you're seeing right now is the fact that the congressional Senate power shifted to Democrats, and you've got an investigation going on vis-a-vis FERC. You've got a lawsuit against El Paso. You've got an investigation going on for the generators and prices in Congress. Lieberman's committee is going to do that. So what you've got is a situation which when these guys meet for beer, they say, you know, maybe million or two bonus this year is enough, and I should really quit, because none of them are going to break ranks. They're all making so damn much money. Who's going to be the first to say that I'm not going to take it? It's just, they're picking your pockets clean, and who's going to stop? I mean, it's very hard. It's a very tough situation. So I don't know how long that's going to stay, or what's going to happen, or what. Yeah.
It's also giving them an opportunity to say, see the market.
See the market works. Absolutely. Absolutely. You'll see that. You're going to see this in the paper. You're going to see a lot of stuff in the paper. Okay, now the other thing just before is that there was also a problem with environmental regulations, which helped make the prices screw. And it has to do with the South Coast Air Quality Management District, SCAQAMD, okay? Some years, one of the problems with Los Angeles and to some extent some days in San Francisco is that NOx, NOx, which is an output of combustion, mixes with sunlight, causes smog, ozone formation and smog. So you want to reduce NOx, and all the utilities were required to reduce NOx. One market mechanism for reducing NOx is to do what's known as NOx credit trading, which basically says if you've got to take 5 pounds of NOx out of your power plant, you can go anywhere you want to get those 5 pounds of NOx. If you get it from somewhere else, go get it. Turns out one of the cheapest places was to go to dry cleaning establishments. So the utilities pay to have dry cleaning establishments take care of the NOx so that they wouldn't have to take care of it in the power plant. So there was a whole bunch of this kind of trading going on. We have SO2 trading, sulfur dioxide, and if you watch the papers carefully, there's discussion about CO2, carbon dioxide trading for global climate change. But that's how it works. Basically, it's a market mechanism that says, go get the pounds to remove the cheapest place you can go get them. It's just, for SO2, for CO2, it's not bad because that's a global problem. But for NOx, you have the problem of having to do it within the airshed because there's no use reducing NOx someplace else because it doesn't affect the air quality within your particular airship. So there's a whole bunch of problems that go with it. But anyway, the utilities convinced the regulators that they don't want to put in selective catalytic reduction, which is SCR, which is a pollution control system, that they would do NOx trading. There was a lot of credits issued. The power plants were sold to the non-utilities with those credits. And there was always in the plan that the South Coast Air Quality District would reduce the number of credits over years. That is, that's how they were eventually going to get the NOx down, okay? And they began to do that. And the prices shot up. Okay? In fact, they got extremely, extremely expensive. So what happened is that people who had NOx that they could abate said, hey, this is really worth something. So they did the good old American thing. They bid the prices up, right? Some of them couldn't continue to generate. They had to reduce production because they couldn't meet the NOx requirements. The Air Board finally stepped in and gave a dispensation to that. But what happened is that when you look back at the cost for the credits during this very crucial period of time, ended up being more than if the plants had put selective catalytic reduction in the first place and just reduced it. So what I'm saying is that there's lots of forces at work here, and we don't quite know how all this stuff works, but all of these things were going at the same time. You had the capacity withholding for maintenance, you had the increase in natural gas prices, and you had the NOx credit business going on.
What do you think Bush's motivation was for negating the high efficiency air conditioning?
My guess is that when the Bush administration took office, they wanted to not do anything that would look like it was last minute stuff left over from Clinton. And it's not the only one. I mean, there's a list of them that happen. You know, all the ergonomics regulations are now under review. All whole bunch of the stuff that had been negotiated for over a number of years but came into the latter part of the Clinton administration, the Bush administration threw all those out. And my guess is that industry complained. They were being technically forced. But they had agreed to them. So, Texas got plenty of electricity. So, well, here's some of the non-causes, okay? Soaring electricity demand. Demand did not increase a lot in California. Not that it didn't increase, but it's not huge. There was a huge electricity demand from the internet. That's absolutely false. There was a big demand in Santa Clara, Silicon Valley, but it was from building web servers and web hotels, which would have been the same as building steel mills or anything else. It was not from the internet itself. There was a very extensive study done by Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. Essentially, the internet takes roughly 2 to 3% of electricity in this country, not that 8 to 13% that's out in the literature. Pardon? Web servers?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they're constant. They take a lot of electricity.
Server farms.
Yeah. Server hotels. Pardon?
That's the reason for a lot of that.
That's it.
Yeah, it's claimed, but again, a server farm to me is an industrial facility that is the same as if you built a steel mill or an automobile manufacturing facility. It just produces something. You don't necessarily blame the automobile industry for the electricity used in the manufacturing process. Okay. Now, Santa Clara and the Silicon Valley have some difficulties in the sense that they're constrained in that area itself, and there's some real difficulty of there's some real difficulty of bringing energy in there. In fact, my view is that if you're going to put any of that kind of facility in, they ought to have their own generation. And as a matter of fact, anything served by wire cannot meet the reliability demands of a microprocessor-based system. And this comes out in the literature that is, when you do things by wire, even if you're running different wires in, you can get about a 99.99% reliability. Most manufacturing facilities that are computer managed plastic injection molding. If you get a voltage spike or you drop the electricity out for 2 seconds, the stuff is frozen in the process, and you've got days to clean it up, okay? A web server, if they drop out, it's a huge thing. You can't get there by wire alone. You've got to have some localized generation or you can't make it. With localized generation, you can get the 99.999% reliability. But you can never beat this problem by just running more wires to it. And people are slowly, very slowly, coming to that realization. Yes?
Eric, as I read over the years, I served on the state youth lift this panel 10 years ago, for 3 years. The potential of storing energy in giant flywheels. Actually, that would make more. They're using flywheels and buses in Switzerland, and I understand that they're accepting. This concept, I guess, could be used to some extent.
My own feeling is that flywheels are going to come in small sizes rather than in the big sizes.
Okay.
The small flywheels are coming in now. And in fact, the first batch of flywheels were floating a satellite for satellite communications. Turns out you do that instead of batteries, you save weight and space, and it's a real cost saver. So I think that if small storage of flywheels becomes viable, it totally changes the dynamic of this industry. All this stuff changes.
Number two is I planted 18,000 trees at my own expense 10 years ago, and so I planted it. And talked with Simpson Lumber at the infogeneration plant up in the Anderson area. And I find, in checking with them recently, that the amount of money that I will get for the trees is still about the cost of harvesting. So I don't know what you're doing. The point is, economics of solving some of the problems and have been totally ignored or possibly suppressed. And I think we should cover that soon.
That's a whole question about, are you willing to pay for clean? Are you willing to pay more or not? How do you do it? Question of externalities. It's a topic all itself, but you're right. Okay, the other thing is, oh my gosh, where did I go? Okay, I skipped one, I think.
Yeah. What's the smallest gas turbine engine generator that you are aware of that's commercially out there?
The smallest?
Yeah.
The smallest generator that I'm aware of is 1 kW.
Okay, that's
microscale. Yes. If you have a well-designed house, it's relatively energy efficient, you shouldn't need more than 2 kW at best. There's 2 kW fuel cells under test, there's 7 kW fuel cells under test, there's 30 kW, 60 kW microturbines presently being installed, like for McDonald's and these kinds of situations. And so there's a whole issue that has to do with this microgeneration, which, all right, let me get on here, Miles. Environmental regulation prevented power plants from being built, okay? What really prevented power plants from being built is, first of all of the BRPU process was thrown out because utilities said we didn't need any generation, the whole uncertainty of deregulation, and the fact that you had these stranded costs which were being paid off, and it really chilled construction except for small stuff in this state. It is true it's tougher to build in California, but on the other hand, do you want to give up the environmental consequences and just forget it or not? So, and the fact that it says California built no power plants in 1990 is also not true. We added it, but they're mostly small. So there was a lot of, and let me put it another way. Whatever we do in Anwar, not drilling, has nothing to do with the power problems in California. Nothing. We don't generate any electricity in this state, or very little, by oil. No, it's supposed to be oil. But there's an argument about how much natural gas there is or isn't. Yeah. All right, now here's the flaws. Utilities sell all the generation. That was done in order to limit their market power. Turns out another group came in and had more market power. Long-term forward contracts prohibited for utilities, again, because they thought that would be, again, a market power thing and kind of a risky, without taking into account what the risk that might be, because it threw you as the customer on the spot market. Great volatility. Loss of control of maintenance schedules. Now you have all of this maintenance capacity outage happening. In the last 20 years, there was never more than 5 to 8% of the power plants out for maintenance. Last winter, it was 18 to 30% of power plants out for maintenance. Highest bid to meet demand sets the market price. That's what I was talking about here, this bidding system about how it's clear that you can really game this system. Okay? There was no consideration of the demand side. I mean, we always talk about demand supply, but you don't really have any response to the price, even if you were got it, except be careful about turning your lights on and off, right? Now there's some places like Georgia Power, which is not deregulated, has a demand side market. They have signed up almost 3,000 megawatts of industrial capacity, and they bid that depending on what their demand is, they will come out and say, which one of you guys wants to quit today at 5 cents a kilowatt hour, 10 cents a kilowatt hour, 15 cents a kilowatt hour? And they usually get about 800 to 1,000 megawatts of response. And so they play a demand side market at the same time. And you are doing that by conserving. You're basically watching how you use, and so you're driving demand down. But you're not doing it so there's an instantaneous demand reduction, and there's a long-term demand reduction. And much of that went down the tubes. And to some, the rate cap, which was this business of keeping the rates here while they collected all these stranded costs, basically said that the electricity price changes didn't get passed on to you. Natural gas did, but not the electricity prices. And the idea was to protect you. On the other hand, I don't know how it's all going to work out, because what you're going to have now is if the energy prices stay low, we just had a price increase. So you're going to pay higher bills when the prices are low. Okay? You paid low bills when the prices were high, and high bills when the prices are low. Okay? Huh? Okay, now the thing is, you can't correct this except by actions between FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and the state. The state alone cannot fix this. My feeling is that is going to be extremely difficult to prove one way or another. And the other thing that I really made me angry is when I found out that state inspectors were not allowed access to the power plants. Private property.
They're not regulated.
Again, you can pass a rule that says if you want to play in this market, you got to allow us to inspect you, right?
So the inspector goes into the office and sits down and has a cup of coffee and chats with the guy, and that's the inspection?
No, he never even got in the door. Okay, so I mean, to some extent, these are extremely difficult things to prove or deal with. I mean, this is these are corrections that we need to deal with. We have to think about. It's not a simple thing. Okay. Yes, you have a question.
Well, let me ask you this hypothetical. If you had been the CEO of PG&E, what would you have done?
What would I have done?
As opposed to not going bankrupt. I mean, if the negotiations with the governor broke off, you have your feelings hurt because of something he said in a press release.
Right. Frankly, if you look at it now, from a sort of PG&E viewpoint, they're better off bankrupt.
Yes.
Then they would be not that gone bankrupt.
They
at least have somebody who makes decisions.
Right.
Okay? In fact, FTE is sitting there right now, all the papers ready. They're ready to get lawyers sitting on it. They can file for bankruptcy in 10 minutes. And my guess is they think about that every morning and decide whether to do it or not.
This is Edison?
Southern California Edison. The regulated side. Not Mission Energy, which is their unregulated side. But so in a way, I'm not sure that PG&E isn't better off. One of the things that broke down the negotiations with PG&E on the transmission line sale was that the state also wanted the right-of-way. PG&E wanted to retain the right-of-way for telecommunications purposes. And they were not willing to give up the right to be able to string cable along that right-of-way. The state wanted that. Why, I have no clue. But so that broke the negotiations down at PG&E. So, you can blame everybody or blame nobody, but basically everybody's firing at everybody else, you know. They're all bleeding and they're all firing at each other. But in the long run, PG&E is much better off now. The big argument at PG&E right now is, where does the money from the rate increase that you're going to pay for go?
Yeah.
Okay? The state has said that all that money goes to the state. Okay? PG&E is then arguing with the bankruptcy judge that some of that ought to flow to the creditors of PG&E. Okay? So there's going to be a big argument of where that goes. But right now, it's going to go to paying off the debt the state's accumulated.
So it probably should get split.
Yeah. Hey. All right. How do we fix the market? Got to change generator behavior. You can talk about price caps. You can drive fixed profits. You can negotiate partial payments. You can have FERC get in there. Somehow you got to get the bidding and the market and the stuff straightened out. And this threat, I don't know what eventually is going to do it. But I know that the people, the guys I still know and work for some of the generator companies, none of them expect to get full payment. None of them expect to get full payment. Increased supply?
Even if they don't at this point, they're still making huge profits.
Absolutely. They just, instead of $1 million bonus, you only get $900,000 bonus. So, you increase supply, which we're doing. We've got all kinds of power plants under construction right now, a big battle, Metcalf, all that you heard about. And you manage demand. You do it by short-term reduction, which is that market I was talking about where the ISO can actually do that, but they're not very good at it. Or you become more efficient as a consumer, and there's money going to go flow out for that. Okay. Here's what's happening now. There's 12 new major power plants licensed, 8,500 megawatts. About 500 or 600 megawatts have come online or will come online this month, and then they'll come on after summer. A whole bunch of them will come on.
This is
California. I mean?
California.
This is California. Yeah. There's demand reduction programs. The legislature passed $800 million for energy efficiency programs of all kinds, and you're going to have a 2020 program, which the utilities are going to compare the amount of electricity you used in June to the amount of electricity that you used last June. If this June you use 20% less, you get a bonus. It comes out of that pot. Okay. And there's all kinds of, there's rebates for photovoltaics, there's rebates for new windows, there's all kinds of money floating out there. The only difficulty I have is that if you don't have an organizational structure to spend money efficiently, it's tough to spend $800 million. It's easy to blow it. It's tough to spend it efficiently.
What do you think can be done to lower the cost? There's been research in the form of voltaics and reduce the cost of production.
Well, that's part of the public purpose programs. Okay, just quickly. Is that the non-hydro renewable industry in California right now is about 7,000 megawatts. We've done very well. We spread it across all kinds of, it's really a kind of a forerunner of where you might want to go in terms of renewables. I've showed you that's about 12% of the total generation, highest in the country. We did have a green power market where you had marketers in here like Green Mountain Energy, and you could buy clean energy if you wanted to. They've all been wiped out by this market, because all of their prices were pegged to the PX, and the PX went out of business. They didn't know what to peg at prices, and they went up. So all the green market basically disappeared. Here's the public purpose programs. And those have been extended. Additional payment to wind power. There's additional payment to photovoltaics. There's additional payments to biomass. There's about, what's 500 divided by 4 is 130, 140 million a year that goes into stimulating the renewable industry. There's about 200 million a year that was going into doing energy efficiency, but that was managed by the Public Utilities Commission. The CEC did a reasonable job with renewables. My own opinion is the Public Utilities Commission basically blew managing the energy efficiency programs. Another story all by itself. The R&D program was sort of sputtering along, but it's now really beginning to kick in. They finally got new management, new manager in there, and there's a low-income family to help the low-income. All of these programs have been extended by the legislature for 10 more years until 2012, and the legislature has just passed some new funds of $880 million for conservation or energy efficiency. So there's a lot of programs out there. Most the CEC has a website. Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory has a website. Each of the utilities have websites that you can go on and find out what you can get rebates for, what you can get reimbursement for.
CEC's website, energy.ca.gov.
I think it's dot US. I don't know, one of them. You go to Yahoo and put California Energy Commission and it'll pop up.
Oh, okay, that's the right way. From the silicon perspective, I mean, the traditional silicon solar cells are not the only ones that are viable. In fact, there are other types of semiconductor materials that, in fact, can convert fluorine into electricity. I'm just wondering if you're familiar with it.
There's amorphous, there's single crystal,
that's right.
There's multi-crystal, there's cadmium, telluride, there's probably five or six out there coming out different products. They're coming out roof shingles, they're coming out all kinds of products.
Mm-hmm. How about dilithium crystals?
there are some crystals around which people rave, but I don't want to do the work. Now the system benefit charges has funded a number of these programs, and so there really is a push for renewables within the state. Now, what's some of the potential? I just thought I'd throw this out, just because I always wonder about these things. Right now, there are long-term contracts for wind power being negotiated by Pacific BPA. The one, they went out for an RFP for 1,000 megawatts of wind and got back 2,800 megawatts of wind. They're negotiating a long-term contract for 1,000 megawatts of wind, probably somewhere at a little less than 3 cents a kilowatt. Pacific Core is doing it for 250 megawatts, and they're getting about 3.1 cents a kilowatt hour. And this is long-term contracts with no escalation clauses. So, and others, there's other negotiation going on. The only difficulty with these is that the real good wind resources are in the Great Plains states, North Dakota, South Dakota, right in the middle of the country. Okay? In fact, it's been called the Saudi Arabia of wind. There is more wind power, even excluding scenic areas, excluding national parks and all the rest of it. There is enough wind potential in that area, roughly the 3 to 5 times the total electrical demand of this country. Now, the difficulty is that demand is not there. You've got to get it out of there. You've got to have the transmission and the ability to get it out of there. And the transmission in that area is relatively weak. And it's run by a federal agency called WAPA. And WAPA doesn't want to get disturbed too much. So, problem, but that there's a real potential out there. And the states are beginning to recognize it. South Dakota is beginning to recognize that the potential for economic development of South Dakota by developing wind is higher than any other thing they've got. They slowly got to them, okay? Slowly. Yes.
There was a special on C-SPAN recently. You talk on wind power, and you're talking about how it's one of the fastest.
It is.
Of generation to get online. And you could actually do a lot of it by needing.
Well, here I go again. I can hit it too hard. One of the things about if things are right, that is, if the transmission's there, power purchase contracts are there, some of these wind stuff is going in 100 megawatt chunks. The contract was signed within the last 2 weeks. And it'll be in by the end of the year. Again, this is all modular. So you know, they're now 1 megawatt, 1.5 megawatt wind turbines and bigger size stuff. Okay, but the problem is, for California, the problem is we have some wind resources developed in our own state. We're not really a state with a lot of good wind resources. Good wind resources are outside the state. The question is, who in California is going to go buy wind? I've been pinging the state, the new state authority that's been, guy's been ahead of this, good friend of mine, Dave Freeman. And I've talked to Dave. I said, why don't you guys go out and buy some long-term wind? Well, he didn't even know what he's in charge of, because the governor hasn't given him a mandate on what to do. So there's a problem just finding out who's in charge of what, at this stage. So, but there is a huge wind potential, and there is in the Pacific Northwest, and there is there. The other thing is, so I don't know how many of you get the Contra Costa Times. I know Don Bradley, and I was at the American Solar Energy Society meeting in the mall. This is the house he built in the mall. Okay, I'll pass it around, in Washington, okay? This is a modular constructed home. It's not a trailer. That is, the walls and windows and everything are put together in a factory-like setup and trucked out to the site and put together out there. Huh? Do you? Yeah. And the new stuff is outstanding, okay? This house has integrated in it photovoltaics and solar hot water heating, efficient appliances. It essentially can run without connection to the grid. Okay? And he can build these, not counting land cost, at $50 to $60 a square foot. Now, if any of you have looked at house building in this area, you're at $125 to $150 a square foot. Just for construction, not land cost. So I keep scratching my head and saying, what's wrong with us? If nothing else, why does the federal government spend all this money on low-income housing and not require it to be like this? Not only do we subsidize the low-income housing, but then we subsidize the ability of people to live in them to pay the utility bills, okay? Yeah, well, the thing is, what all of these things do is they upset the established system. And any time you upset that, there's going to be winners and losers. And obviously the people who are winners now don't want to become losers. So you have a huge interplay of things going on. We have very perverse incentives, about some of this. And the building industry, a third of the energy in this country is essentially used up by structures, buildings. We turn over the building stock at a rate of about 1% a year. So when you put in a building that's energy efficient, it eats energy for a long, long period of time.
About 16 years ago, I heard from Voice Express, including a wind farm, about an hour and a half north of here. It was a wind tunnel that goes into Travis Air Force Base, which wasn't well known for its existence. I had the figures that showed that they could easily put in enough wind generators to replace the first nuclear power plant at Dallas Carriage. And they weren't interested in that because they hadn't thought of it. And so right now I have in my garage four small wind turbines that have been mounted on sailboats.
Oh, the small one, the 500 watt ones? Yeah.
And real good, already perfectly handle them. And ready to go. I've got the batteries, the cable, and everything. But I haven't decided yet how to put them in the ground because there's building permits required. NAPA has got an ordinance prohibiting building permits for windmills. There's one
small one.
There's one in the whole county that I know it's right across the road from.
All of these things go against established building codes. They go against established. There's a whole shift. If we really want to go to a clean, more sustainable energy system, it impinges on a lot of other things that exist, building codes and all the rest of that stuff.
However, I have 2 5-ton trucks.
And then what? You're going to take off with them? Okay. But the other thing is that rooftop TV, just putting a photovoltaic panel on them, the rebate for that has just gone up. And so that you get more than half the cost of this rebated under the present program, okay? So.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any particular. I try not to make a choice between which kind of PV it is. My feeling is that that ought to be taken care of by whoever sells you the PV. One of the things about amorphous is that it's not as efficient as the single crystal silicon, so you have to have a bigger roof surface. So you've got a balance in there, okay? For instance, if I was putting it on a remote repeater site for telecommunications, I would never go for amorphous. I would go for single crystal because I know that stuff's been out there for 30 years and has operated and operated. I don't have that kind of history in amorphous. On the other hand, all of the roof shingles and stuff where basically if you re-roof the house, you do it with photovoltaic shingles, is all amorphous. So it has to do with a specific application, and I try not to get myself... One of the Europeans are going big for offshore wind.
I mean, could it be like wind barges that, you know, are a mile out of sea with the plasters or something?
Well, the cost of that just doesn't make it. Now, the thing is that the Europeans go for offshore installations because they have limited land surface and high population densities. For us, we still have a lot of land. We don't have the sort of driver for that yet. There's so much wind out there that you could get cheaper than have to go offshore. And frankly, I do not believe that in the environmental consciousness in California that you will be able to line the shore of California with wind turbines. Okay? Well, the only place where there's really been bird kills has been in the Altamont. They've not shown up on any other wind turbines around, and you do have to not sight them in the flyways of birds. Well, you know, you shouldn't put it by airports anyway, yeah, but there's been a... Well, with Travis?
Yeah.
Well, but they're not interfering with the glide path. But there was a real catastrophe in Spain when they sighted a bunch of wind turbines in the glide path of the cranes that migrate from Africa into Spain and really chop them up. The U.S. Air Force has the best information in this country on bird migratory paths. And you got to sight the wind farms in, you have to be sensitive to that and sight them. Where that's been sensitive to that, there's been no problems with regard to bird kills. In fact, you kill more birds a year with TV tower guy wires than you do in wind turbines. Yeah, you had a question.
How is wind power stored?
Not. Fed into the grid.
Wind farms.
Oh, that's what it's called because it's a bunch of wind turbines all in an area. Okay. Now the interesting thing, the reason it's called wind farms is because you're harvesting the wind off the surface there. No, it just goes into the grid. Yeah. In fact, one of the things is that if you take a look at the farm subsidy program in this country, there are wind turbines showing up in the Midwest, Wisconsin, Minnesota, where the revenue from the wind turbine on the land, in fact, the wind turbine only takes up 3-4% of the land surface, so you can still farm the rest of it, that the revenue off the wind turbine is higher than the revenue off the crop. One of my policy recommendations, which nobody has listened to and I can't get anybody to listen to, is for the federal government begin to use farm subsidy programs to assist farmers for putting wind on their land and withdraw them from the farm subsidy program. We're going to run into real world trade problems with our continued farm subsidy program on these days. And there's ways to shift the farmer over into harvesting wind instead of only crops, diversify his revenue sources. If you really want to save a small farmer, that's one way to do it.
Yeah. Have you seen a reliable figure on the maintenance for wind farms, what factors annually? I understand that there's a big issue about durability of wind farms.
That issue is going away. The 10 years ago, that was a really big issue. And the newer technologies that are coming in are really very, very good. When wind is blowing, they're available 99% of the time. The cost of maintenance has gone way down. So
the material science problem. Yeah. Look at 5% of power generation.
You mean maintenance costs?
Yes.
I don't know it in those terms. Maintenance costs have dropped down to below below 0.1 cent per kilowatt hour.
The ones that I have self-dancing blades. They have automatic voltage regulators built into each unit. They have a 4-foot wingspan. They're to be mounted to 10 to 15.
Remember that we ought to distinguish here between small wind turbines and large wind turbines, okay? The big wind farms are large turbines. They're huge.
Small ones. And you look at them once a year and one man can service them. You can bring them down by hand.
Yeah, the small ones are also have gotten a lot better. You get the small, up to the 10 kW, 20 kW, small wind turbines will run for years and years and years without any maintenance. Because the whole science of permanent magnets has gone up. So you have practically no moving parts in these things at all.
Okay.
And the blades will fold up in a high wind, they're self-stalling. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's come in that's really made the technology move in the last 10 years. Yes?
I wonder if you think about tidal power.
Tidal power, okay. Tidal power is a tough game. And at this point, it is still relatively expensive. The best work on tidal power is presently being done in the UK and in Norway. And the Norwegians have got some fairly efficient tidal facilities, but they don't. The cost factors are still up so high that until you exhaust something else, you're not going to need that, unless you're in some place where that's the only place that you can do it.
Energy in the tidal,
well, no, the fact that you don't have a lot of energy in them to begin with, which means you have to have fairly large facilities to capture it, and then salt water is a tough material. It's really hard to maintain things that get submersed in salt water. The only entity I know that does a good job with that is Mother Nature. Anything man's always stuck in the ocean gets eaten up. I mean, we have a tough time with it. Yes, ma'am.
Chicago should be able to run itself.
Who? Chicago?
Yeah, should be able to run itself.
Wind power? Oh, in Chicago? Yeah. Well, actually, Chicago gets supplied by wind power. It comes up from Wisconsin, Minnesota, up in an area called Buffalo Ridge. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, if you don't have to have them in your backyard, put them in somebody else's backyard. Come on, that's NIMBY is a good way to go, you know?
I'm working on a current project in California.
Yes, there is.
It scales to about 2 million a megawatt over 50 years.
2 million a megawatt. Okay. Roughly speaking, the cost figure you think of is a million a megawatt, so you're about twice.
Yeah, acres are about 1.25 million. This one amortized over time is going to be a figure.
One of the difficulties with most of the renewables is that they have high capital costs but low operating costs, whereas the fossil fuel is low capital cost and high operating costs. So in essence, what you have to do with renewables, you buy the fuel up front by the higher capital cost. So if you amortize it over a period of time, it can come out to be a great deal cheaper. But the problem is amassing that capital up front to build it in the first place. And that takes a special deal to do that, right? That's not the way we're... It's easier to buy a gas turbine and gamble and take the risk on natural gas prices pass the price on to you, than to build a wind farm, because you've got to amass a whole bunch of capital that you now have to amortize over a longer period of time to make them cost comparative. And it makes it, in the way we do calculations in terms of cost efficiency and buybacks and so on, this becomes a real hurdle unless there is a way that you take care of that by low-cost loans or special amortization schedules or whatever else you can do with it. Yes, you had another question back there?
There was a BP Solar partnered with Vallejo to put in a 1 megawatt solar facility. It came in at $7 million.
Vallejo? Not Fairfield?
I was in Vallejo.
And did what? Made silicon?
1 megawatt.
Or PV?
This is PV.
I don't know of any in Vallejo. I know one in Fairfield. The PV facility is in Fairfield.
This was something that was in the paper last week.
I don't know. I can't tell you about that one. But the one I know that BP owns is in Fairfield. Okay, where are we going in the future? If you don't know where you're going, any of it'll do. So one of the things we've got to talk about is like, okay, because you guys are going to get tired of, oh, no, I don't want to end the show. Come on, where did this come from? All right. Now, here's my definition. Okay, I'm trying. All right. Now, it may be a little complicated, but what we really want to do is we want a clean, sufficient, affordable supply, and we want to meet the needs for smart, efficient customers. And the reason I use the word smart in there, I mean, we have the capability now to know a lot more what's going on and controlling a lot more stuff than we did in the past. And so what we want is we want energy that includes fossil renewables, energy efficiency. We want it centrally located. We want it distributed because you can't get the reliability and security by only having big power plants. And you want to utilize information technology to manage all this because you can do that now to make all efficiently in use and allow them meaning and allow customers some efficient choices. I guess I'm hitting the wrong button here. Okay, here's my definition of what sustainable energy means to me is that you have to move closer to the near-term flux of the sun, the heat of the earth, and the pull of gravity. If we've got this Faustian bargain, you use fossil fuel, you'll always screw up the earth. And so, you know, eventually you've got to move in this direction. If you don't have sun, we're gone anyway. Okay? I mean, these are conditions for mankind to exist, right? When they're not there, we're gone. And right now, we only have three ways to go. One is high efficiency conversion of relatively clean fuels, like natural gas or hydrogen. We've got to use renewables, and we've got to use energy efficiency. I mean, there isn't many other choices, and there's no one simple solution. And like I said, there's no silver bullet. There's only silver buckshot. You can't get there. The other thing is that one of the things that's going on very big in this country, and one of the arguments you're probably going to get involved in sometime in the future, and my guess is it's going to be about between 2 to 4 years, 2 to 5 years, is the sequestration of CO2. Okay? Right now, there's huge experiments going on. In fact, there's more research money going into CO2 sequestration than they're going into renewables in this country today. And the idea there is to take coal, basically gasify coal, separate the gas streams, separate the CO2, separate all the other stuff, take the CO2 and pump it back underground. Under most of the earth, there is a saline reservoir, huge saline water reservoir, about, 2,000 or 3,000 feet down, that's apparently trapped in there. And there's big experiments now going on. They're going on in Norway. They're going on in the Pacific.